supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. The science of psychology intersects with peace, historically speaking, and still today. On today's show, we'll help illustrate this with conversations with some of the contributors to the October special edition of The American Psychologist. It's their issue on peace psychology. Let's begin with Irvin Staub. He's the lead author of an article called Building a Peaceful Society, Origins, Prevention, and Reconciliation After Genocide and Other Group Violence. Staub was born in Hungary, where as a young child he lived through Nazism and then Communism. He escaped from there when he was 18 and eventually arrived at the U.S. He's a professor of psychology emeritus at the University of Massachusetts. He founded their program on the psychology of peace and violence. Irvin Staub, welcome to Voices in the Family.
Thank you very much for having me.
Irvin, in your article, you say that the 20th century was one of genocide and other great violence between groups. You know, it was a little more than 50 years ago we dropped an atomic bomb in Japan. So are these increases in genocide simply because we're learning how to kill each other better, or is there something else going on?
Unfortunately, one of the things that may go on is modeling, that when people see a genocide, when an elite or a leadership or one particular ethnic group in a society deals with conflict with another group by attempting to eliminate that group, that gives ideas to people later on. So, for example, when Hitler was talking to his Nazi fellow leaders, he said to them famously, "We can go ahead. Who has ever heard about the Armenians?" Meaning that the Armenians were killed by Turkey and nobody made a fuss about it, and so we can go ahead also and people will not make a big fuss about it either. So I think that one of the things that happens is that people see that countries, groups do this and they get ideas from that. But there may also be other elements, and that is, it's possible that community is more disrupted in the modern age than it used to be.
Explain, what do you mean?
In the old system of feudalism, for example, where peasants did have very little right, there was a sense of connection and caretaking by the rulers, by big landowners, of people over whom they ruled. But I think that these connections have gotten more disrupted and people have come to feel more disconnected and alone. And when that is the case and life conditions are challenging, when there is economic deterioration, when there is political chaos in a society, when there are very big changes, then being alone, atomized, so to speak, not feeling deeply connected to others, people become desperate. And I believe that under conditions like that, there are profound psychological needs. Even apart from material needs, it's even more the case that psychological needs are disrupted. The need for a feeling of security, the need for connection to other people, the need for a positive identity, for feeling good about yourself, a need for understanding the world around you, an understanding that is disrupted by these conditions of life. And so one of the things that happens is that people turn towards leaders and some group, which may be their ethnic group, or it may be a new group that is an ideological movement.
Yeah, I read a study several years ago that said when people experience a kind of existential threat, they're more likely to follow a powerful leader who promises safety and security by whatever means necessary.
Absolutely right. And it is also the case that following such a leader, people come to feel connected to each other. They feel more that they are part of a group. That gives them some feeling of security, connection, and identity.
Well, depending on the leader, that could be a good thing.
It could be a good thing. Unfortunately, under these conditions, it is often a problematic thing. And one of the reasons is that some group in society is often scapegoated, blamed for the problems. And then other, which is even worse, is that groups often come up with some kind of a hopeful vision, but it is a hopeful vision only for their own group. It could be nationalism, it could be purity, ethnic purity, religious purity. It could even be something that sounds really good, like social equality. The Khmer Rouge in Cambodia came up with that idea. They wanted to create social equality. But the problem is that usually others are identified as standing in the way of fulfilling this vision. And so the group then turns against these others.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about peace psychology today on Voices in the Family. My guest is Irvin Staub. He's a professor of psychology emeritus at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. He founded their program on the psychology of peace and violence. He's the lead author of the article Building a Peaceful Society: Origins, Prevention, and Reconciliation After Genocide and Other Group Violence. It appears in the October special issue of the American Psychologist. I want to understand these perpetrators of violence. My mentor was a young psychologist during the Nuremberg trials, and he was over there to help interpret some of the Rorschach tests, the ink blot tests on some of these Nazi mass murderers. He told me it was eerie to look at these test results and see an absence of glaring pathology, that these guys were roughly within normal limits. He said it really shook him.
Yes. You know, these people are not conventionally mentally disturbed. Now, we could talk about moral disturbance of some kind, but it is the case that we human beings are guided by powerful ideas. These people usually saw some kind of a utopian world, and then the means to create that utopian world, immoral and horrible as they were, kind of didn't matter so much. But it is also the case that this doesn't just come about suddenly, that groups that develop scapegoating and develop these ideologies then begin to harm another group and members of that group, and then they change. When you begin to harm other people and there are no constraining forces, then you justify what you did. You explain it in terms of the higher ideals of the ideology, and then it becomes more possible to do it again and at a greater degree. So there is this evolution, change in individuals, in the group, in institutions, that can end in horrible violence. Now, one good thing is that such an evolution can also take place in a positive direction.
How so?
Well, I have done research, for example, with children, where we got children to do things like make toys for poor hospitalized children, or an older child teach a younger child, or other ways getting them to be helpful. And as a result, they became more helpful in comparison to children who were engaged in similar but not helpful activities. You know, the same thing with rescuers during the Holocaust. Unfortunately, in the course of this evolution that I talked about, witnesses, bystanders, people who are neither perpetrators nor part of the targeted group, remain passive. But once a genocide begins, then people see that this terrible thing is really happening, and a very small number of people endanger themselves and even their families to try to help people who are targeted for killing. This happened in the Holocaust, this happened in Rwanda, where I have done a lot of work, this happened in Turkey during the Armenian Genocide. And often, such rescuers begin very small. They agree to save someone or to hide someone in a basement, in an attic room, or somewhere whom they have known, or who some intermediary from the community asks them to hide.
Who are these people, Irvin, that risk their lives? What do we know about them?
Well, we actually know a fair amount about them as a result of some significant research. One of the kinds of things we know about them is that they are raised by their parents in certain ways.
Which ways?
Well, in societies where physical punishment of the children is very common, instead, the parents are likely to reason with them, to explain why they should behave in certain ways or do certain things. There is also quite a bit of affection in the family. Another thing is that they grow up in families that engage with people outside the immediate group, the immediate religious group or ethnic group. So, for example, if you are in Poland, Polish Catholics are the very large majority. But rescuers grew up in families where the parents engaged with people who were not Polish Catholics, including Jews. So there is this connection to people who are usually identified as the other and who are devalued. Another thing is that one of these parents often is a helper, somebody who is a humanitarian. So the children have positive guidance, affectionate guidance, they have the example of a helper, and they also have the experience of connection so that they can overcome the devaluation that people hold for members of that outside group that is designated for genocide.
So as long as we're talking about families here, if you don't mind, I'd like to talk a little bit about your history. Like I said, when I introduced you, you were born in Hungary, you lived through Nazism and then communism before you escaped to Vienna when you were 18 years old. You were clearly part of what you refer to as a group trauma. So what was it that prevented you from becoming either violent or depressed?
All right, well, I will talk a little bit about my experience, and then I want to talk about a more general principle. I was helped at the time when these terrible things were happening, first of all, by the Swede, Raoul Wallenberg, who is well known for his heroic actions. Mm-hmm. Wallenberg was not a diplomat, but he agreed to go to Hungary to try to save Jews, and he was appointed as a diplomat, and he came there, he went there with determination to help as much as he could. He created these so-called protective passes that said that this person after the war will go to Sweden and will become a Swedish citizen. And the Hungarian government at that time accepted him, creating 4,000 of these. Well, he created many more and handed it out to people under all kinds of circumstances. He did everything he could to save lives. Even more important in influencing me was this woman who lived with us, who worked for my family. She helped with raising children, with cooking, and so on. But she also was very loving and caring, and she was my second mother. And she came with us when we had to leave. She took my sister and me into hiding for a while, then brought us back when we moved into a so-called protective house that Wallenberg set up. It was not well protected because there were raids all the time, but we had very little food, so this woman would prepare dough, put it in a baby carriage, take it to a bakery, bring it back to feed not only us but other people. She was once stabbed, made to stand with her hands up at the wall. She was told that she was going to be killed because she's helping Jews. Then somebody from the neighborhood, who was also Nazi, came in, who knew her well, and said, oh, this is a good woman, let her go. They let her go. She immediately continued. At some point, soon after, I got my PhD at Stanford, and I started my first job at Harvard. I started to do, on a small scale, research on what leads people to help others and what stops them from helping others. And then from then moved on to studying genocide and its prevention and working in Rwanda on reconciliation. And now I am back to where I started. I am extremely concerned about raising inclusively caring children, children who care not only about their own group but also everybody else, and children who are morally courageous. So they will later be active bystanders who work to prevent harm and also to build a peaceful and harmonious society.
So, the message for those listening to the show is a simple act of kindness to someone who's suffering can really change their lives in fundamental ways.
Yes.
Irvin Staub, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and especially thank you for this really important work you're doing.
Thank you very much for having me as part of your show.
Staub is a professor of psychology emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He founded their program on the psychology of peace and violence. He's the lead author of the article Building a Peaceful Society, Origins, Prevention, and Reconciliation After Genocide and Other Group Violence. It appears on the October special issue of The American Psychologist. He's the author of Overcoming Evil, Genocide, Violent Conflict, and Terrorism. My dear friend Sharon Salzberg writes about mindfulness and compassion. Her new book is called Love Your Enemies. She says this might involve stepping outside of ourselves.
Once I was on a train going into New York City, and I found myself sitting between a woman engaged in a rather loud conversation on her cell phone and a man on the other side of me growing increasingly agitated by the volume of her call. And as the ride went on, accompanied by the steady sound of her voice and the minute details of her plans, he started to wiggle and grunt and mutter and finally exploded. "You're making too much noise," he yelled at the top of his lungs. I was sitting there in between the two of them and looked over at him and thought, well, so are you. To deal with antagonists, those we feel angry toward, begins with a willingness to step into new terrain and explore the zone between those we care about and draw toward us and those we wall off and reject. The philosopher Peter Singer calls this process expanding the moral circle of those about whom we are concerned. For example, when we're caught in gridlock and we freak out about the traffic, we forget that we too are the traffic. We may be part of the problem as well as potentially part of the solution. This reminds me of the quotation from Albert Einstein where he says, "The significant problems that we face cannot be solved by the same level of thinking that created them." So So are we willing to step into a different kind of thinking to stop the solidification of self and other and us and them and begin to think in terms of we, us all in this together, somehow winning or losing together, and begin a new way of thinking that is willing to look at completely different solutions for what problems we may face every day.
Sharon Salzberg is the founder of the Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts. She's written Love Your Enemies, along with Buddhist writer Robert Thurman. Coming up, more on the intersection of psychology and peace. Hey, here's something to think about during the break. How can the same motivation for peacemaking do the opposite and plunge some people into destructive, even savage behaviors? I'm Dan Gottlieb, and this is Voices in the Family, right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
Do you feel the need to check and recheck constantly? Are you a prisoner of certain rituals and compulsions? Keystone Clinical Studies in Norristown is conducting a research study of an investigational medication for treating obsessive-compulsive disorder, or OCD. If you're between 18 and 65 and have been diagnosed with OCD, you may be eligible to participate. 610-277-8073, 610-277-8073, or keystoneclinicalstudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. On today's show, we're looking at some really interesting links between the science of psychology and peace. In this segment, a look at the concept of self-love as it applies to the psychology of terrorism. My guest is social psychologist Ari Kruglansky, distinguished professor of psychology at the University of Maryland. He recently wrote about this for the journal The American Psychologist in an article entitled Terrorism, a Self-Love Story. Ari, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Dan.
Well, predictably, the title of your article was what caught my eye, as you described terrorism as a self-love story. So start there.
Well, indeed, in the same way as there is the phenomenon of self-hate, there is also the issue of self-love, which is the other aspect of us being very dependent on the opinion of others on how we view ourselves. So if we expect that the others would despise us, we will despise ourselves to some extent. If we expect that others will admire us, this will validate our positive self-regard. And it's in that context that I see terrorism as a reaction to humiliation and degradation and the feeling that others are rejecting us, which is, of course, a very unpleasant feeling that motivates the restoration of one's feelings of self-significance.
Okay. My understanding is that isolation, social pain can lead to many things. I mean, we see this with, you know, terrorists in schools and these kids who do these horrible things. We often hear they're the ones that are isolated, but certainly not everybody who's isolated becomes violent. Many become depressed.
Absolutely. The explosive mix here is the feelings of a loss of significance with the opportunity for the restoration of significance that is provided by the ideology. So if you combine a loss of significance, humiliation, degradation with an ideology that tells you the way to restore your significance, and in fact to gain immense boost to your significance, is through violence and terrorism against bad people, this is a very tempting proposition that many succumb to.
Then it sounds like street gangs are not like terrorists, even though they terrorize people. But all of those elements are there, but the people they attack and harm, they don't necessarily see as bad people. Do they, or do they? Perhaps they do.
In the case of street gangs, a society that pretty much rejects them, and they feel that they're getting back and leveling the playing field by demonstrating their power. Street gangs members usually are not ones that are well equipped to function well within the prescribed rules and regulations of society, and therefore they establish their own ideology, their own code of honor, their own ways of being significant, and one of these ways is being tough and violent and against a community that rejected them or potentially where they could not attain significance.
So when I listen to this through the eyes of a simple clinician here, we all need to feel part of, to feel connected to a larger culture. And I think this is part of the reason why kids have sex or smoke cigarettes or use drugs, even when they don't really want to. But how do some kids draw the line and others not?
Well, it depends on how committed you are to this a quest for restoration or boost your significance. But to the extent that you feel that all other avenues, all other means of attaining significance are barred, then you would be the kind of individual that would be persuadable to recruitment and to engagement in violent activities.
I want to open this up a bit. I don't want to paint everything with the same brush.
Okay.
Terrorism is about an idea or value, as you said. But one could argue that there was terrorism against white rule in South Africa, and there was. The majority of the country, black and colored South Africa, were isolated, they were devalued, they had an ideology that they believed in, and the African National Congress engaged in what could be called terrorism.
Correct.
They destroyed parts of the country.
Well, you know, it's been said many, many times that the label of terrorism is in the eye of the beholder. And one person's terrorist is another individual's freedom fighter. One way of justifying terrorism is to minimize concerns, to dehumanize the victims, to suggest that they well merit the violence because they were the ones who inflicted violence upon the community that the terrorism is trying to defend. So, you know, it's really a very subjective judgment of whether somebody is a radical or a terrorist. It's not objective reality.
That's a pretty frightening thought. I want to take a minute, Ari, and reintroduce you, and I want to talk about this process of de-radicalization and re-radicalization. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Ari Kruglansky, and he's written an article for the American Psychologist called Terrorism, a Self-Love Story. Let's talk about this business of radicalizing people and de-radicalizing them. So I can see John Doe in whatever country feels isolated and alienated and as though his people are being oppressed. He becomes radicalized by this group of similarly oppressed people who have a plan.
He becomes radicalized. This person becomes ready to adopt
radical means that are means that are detrimental to other concerns. And this becomes justifiable through the ideology that tells you that these means are morally acceptable because those others are well deserving of the harm, and also that these means are effective. So one way of deradicalization is to forcefully and compellingly argue the opposite, that these means are actually unacceptable from the standpoint of the values that you subscribe to. So, for example, in many deradicalization programs in Muslim countries, it's via a theological argument demonstrating that the Quran is against the killing of innocents and against self-suicide of the kind that has been inappropriately called jihad. The other way is to show that these means are simply ineffectual, that not only they will not bring you the honor and self-significance that you vied for, but to the contrary, they'll bring you dishonor and shame.
You distinguish between de-radicalization and shifting goals.
Well, de-radicalization, in my definition, is abandonment of the means of violence, coming to believe that this means is either unacceptable or ineffectual. That would be de-radicalization in the purest sense of the term. That does not necessarily mean abandoning the goal. For example, if the goal is to attain significance by serving your country, you may find alternative means of serving your country through pro-social avenues, through contribution to society that do not involve violence and are constructive rather than destructive.
And Ari, one final question. Would I be naive if I said, what about prevention? Is it possible? How can we do it?
I think it's extremely important. You know, we have been carrying out the research on deradicalization of people who have already been radicalized, suspected terrorists in detention centers, people in prisons, and people who have already been apprehended. But the more important thing is to reach individuals who are vulnerable, who are at risk of becoming radicalized. And I think to prevent radicalization is a much larger issue, because there are huge numbers of people, for example, young Muslims, who are vulnerable to propaganda that talks about the suffering of all Muslims on the hands of Westerners, the injustice, the unfairness, the desecration of Islam, and so forth. So it's extremely important to be preventative and to understand the psychological issues that radicalization entails, and create programs not only aimed at those who are already radicalized, but those who are at risk of becoming radicalized.
Well, Ari Kruglansky, I want to thank you for joining us. This has been, your work is certainly very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Ari Kruglansky is a social psychologist best known for his work on cognitive closure. He's a distinguished professor of psychology at the University of Maryland, and he's one of the authors of the article Terrorism, a Self-Love Story, featured in the American Psychologist special issue on peace psychology, published in October. Coming up, cognitive scientist Stephen Lewandowski talks to us about misinformation, disinformation, and violent conflict. More in a minute on today's show about peace psychology. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and this is Voices in the Family, right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
Do you feel the need to check and recheck constantly? Are you a prisoner of certain rituals and compulsions? Keystone Clinical Studies in Norristown is conducting a research study of an investigational medication for treating obsessive-compulsive disorder, or OCD. If you're between 18 and 65 and have been diagnosed with OCD, you may be eligible to participate. 610-277-8073, 610-277-8073, or KeystoneClinicalStudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. On today's show, we're getting some insight into some fascinating topics raised in October's Peace Psychology edition of the American Psychologist. In this segment, I'm joined by Stephen Lewandowski. He's a cognitive scientist and professor in the School of Experimental Psychology at the University of Bristol in the UK. He's one of several writers behind the article Misinformation, Disinformation, and Violent Conflict, From Iraq and the War on Terror to Future Threats to Peace. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you were the impetus for having an entire journal devoted to psychology and peace. So what's your vision about the role psychology and psychologists can play in creating peace?
Well, I think psychologists have a lot of different roles to play in that. And that was one of the things that got me interested in this issue, is the multiplicity of different things that psychologists can do to work towards conflict resolution, towards preserving peace and making conflicts more manageable.
Well, I want to focus now then on your topic about misinformation and disinformation. So your opening statement said that the control of information is an indispensable ingredient in violent conflict.
Yes, I think it always has been. If you go through history, one of the, you know, recurrent themes that people talk about is that war isn't just about fighting and killing people. It's also about dominating the narrative, the public perception of what the war is about and who the good people are and whose cause is somehow better than somebody else's cause. And I think psychology has a lot to offer about how those narratives about a war come to pass and what the consequences are of information being disseminated. And so, yeah, that's what I work on, one of the things I work on.
So, of course, the military has to employ misinformation to train young men and women to kill young men and women. So in World War II, Vietnam, you know, and all wars, propaganda generated hatred for the enemy. You know, I was thinking as I was reading your article that, you know, in Iraq, the atrocities in Abu Ghraib prison never would have happened if we saw them as humans just like we are.
Probably not, no. And in fact, I think, you know, what my article, the case my article is making, that American troops probably wouldn't even have been in Abu Ghraib if it hadn't been for, you know, the public being misinformed about crucial aspects of the situation, such as the existence of weapons of mass destruction that later on then turned out to be absent, because one of the things the research shows pretty clearly is that in the lead up to the war, belief in the existence of those weapons of mass destruction was a very, very strong predictor of whether members of the public in the U.S. Supported the war.
So many people who supported the war at the time, when they thought about it after the fact, they thought they really didn't know, they really didn't believe or trust that there were weapons of mass destruction. So What is that cognitive process that enabled us to not trust a part of our thinking and to trust someone else's thinking?
I think what people tend to do is to trust information that fits within the overarching framework in which a problem is presented. So in the lead-up to the war in Iraq, the predominant frame in the American media was one of America being the victim of 9/11 and of Iraq being a villain for a number of reasons. You know, eventually the main reason was weapons of mass destruction. But there is a lot of evidence that the media in the lead-up to the Iraq war were portraying Saddam Hussein as a sort of a demon or devil or just an evil person totally at odds with the values of Americans.
Well, I want to follow up on that narrative that you talked about. When we talked about terrorism with Ari Kruglansky, he said that, you know, we talked about South Africa and the ending of apartheid, and we talked about Israel in 1946, and he said that one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter, and take away the violence, and you'll find they're both social activists. So we frame the narrative as a war on terror. And
exactly.
The other side frames the narrative as the United States has an interest in destroying their country and their religion.
Indeed. And that is a crucial to understand how these different framings or narratives make a difference to the propensity or the likelihood of warfare. And let's stay with the terrorism metaphor for just another minute or so. The Bush administration, after 9/11, was very quick in framing the entire response as being one of warfare. Now, it turns out that if you look at precedents in history, then it is usually the case that the more successful framing of a response to terrorism is not war, but a police action. So if you look at Northern Ireland, for example, and the British response to the violence in Northern Ireland, even though that was almost warlike in its framing, there was nonetheless a growing emphasis on police crime, thinking of terrorism really as just a form of crime that has to be met by police work rather than by war. And there is good evidence to suggest that that is a more successful approach to terrorism, that it is considered to be a criminal event that has to be met with police means and actions rather than a military response.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Stephen Lewandowski. He's a cognitive scientist and professor in the School of Experimental Psychology at the University of Bristol in the UK. And we're talking about misinformation and disinformation. And I want to back up a little bit, Stephen, about this.
Sure.
You know, the control of information is all about framing a debate. Also, we see that here in the United States in daily activities of Congress and the executive branch. But that hopefully isn't turning to violence, although I'm not good at predicting the future. So what's the difference?
The difference between what legitimate framing and going beyond that?
Well,
that's a very interesting question. And, of course, it's always extremely difficult to resolve that at the time when the frame is being created. Let me first of all say that having a narrative and having a frame to disseminate information is probably indispensable, because there is so much information out there that you've got to filter some things at the expense of other things. Otherwise, you never get out of your front yard, because you would just be listening to the radio all day. You've got to have an efficient way of communicating problem arises when a central element of the narrative or the framing turns out to be incorrect, at least in retrospect. And that was certainly the case with Iraq and the weapons of mass destruction, which didn't exist. And so the problem is not the existence of a frame or a narrative, but from my point of view, psychologically, the problem is what happens if a central element of that framing is wrong.
Come back to the elections in this country. Well, 90% of these fear tactics that both parties use, they're wrong.
If you say so. I mean, yes, that's confirming basically what I'm saying, that if the problem is not the framing per se, the problem is if things are being framed by relying on information that's incorrect, yes.
There's got to be some kind of disconnect that enables us to accept illogical information. I had dinner the other night with a dear friend of mine. I'm very close to him, and he's a very, very bright guy. And he believes that the Bible was literally written by God, and he also believes that there were dinosaurs. But he also believes that science got it wrong and God got it right, and that the dinosaurs were here within the past 5,000 years. So I'm really interested, though, in the cognitive process here.
The cognitive process, I would argue, is something known as motivated cognition, where people approach a situation by having such a strong need for the information to be of a certain type that is all they take in. So basically, people have, you know, we all have our own personal worldviews and the way we think the world ought to be. And sometimes the need for the world to be just the way we think it should be is so overpowering that we selectively only take in information that's, consonant with that expectation. And one of the really interesting things about the research is that once people believe such information, let's go back maybe to Iraq just briefly, once people believe that they were weapons of mass destruction, then it becomes very difficult to dislodge that information, provided it is central to people's worldview.
Yeah, go on. I want to hear this, because I think our country changed its worldview after 9/11.
Absolutely. It probably did, indeed. And it became much more open to the suggestion that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and that that America was under threat. And once people accepted that, once people thought there were weapons of mass destruction, and once it was related to their worldviews, it has become increasingly difficult to convince people of the opposite, of the fact that there weren't any weapons of mass destruction. And there's a number of experiments that have now shown something that's called the worldview backfire effect. And it's a fascinating result. What it means is that if a person believes something that is incorrect, but that is supporting their worldview, then if you tell them, hang on, that's wrong, in actual fact, this other thing is the case, then instead of accepting that correction, people become more entrenched in their belief. So let me give you an example. There was a study done by Brendan Nyhan and colleagues. He's at Dartmouth, where they presented Republicans and Democrats with evidence or with the fact that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Well, it turns out that as a result, those people who believed in the existence of weapons of mass destruction previously and who were strongly identified with the Republican Party, they became even more convinced of that false information as a consequence of the correction. So the correction backfired.
That's really interesting. And I want to thank you for taking the time to join us from across the pond. And I want to thank you for what you've done for psychology and the work you're doing in trying to use our skills to promote peace. Thank you, Stephen. Stephen Lewandowski is a cognitive scientist at the University of Bristol in the UK. He's the lead writer of an article called Misinformation, Disinformation, and Violent Conflict, From Iraq and the War on Terror to Future Threats to Peace. It was published in the October edition of The American Psychologist. As you can imagine, I've been thinking a lot about peace psychology in preparation for this show. And something came to mind the other morning, and I jotted a few notes down. It's called pronouns. When I becomes us, when they become we, when those people become my people, when the person in the street with his styrofoam cup becomes my brother, or my sister, when the hungry children around the world become my children, then I will cry more and laugh more and love more. Then I'll awaken to the world and say, good morning, what can I do for you today? To download our podcast, go to whyy.org/voices. You can follow us on Twitter, we're at Voices in the Fam, and reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineers for today's show have been Al Banks, Kevin Griffin, and Adam Staniszewski. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. And Jennifer Lynn is our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends. Thank you.